Hello and welcome to episode 15 of the Poolside Pass podcast. On today's episode, I'm joined by Rob Greenwood. Rob currently coaches up in the north of England with Pioneer 79, but previously he's coached over in Singapore with British Swimming in Manchester and also at Stirling University. Today's episode, we're going to be talking about all things coaching, really, about the model he uses, the Anne Albrecht model, as well as his experiences in the sport with coaching. Before we get into the interview with Rob, just a quick word from our sponsors, Streamlined. Become a qualified swimming teacher with Streamlined in as little as 6 days. Learn at your own pace and be guided by our expert tutors. You can do your training face-to-face, online in real time, or a combination of the two. Assessment can be in your club using videos or attending one of our assessment venues. We offer tailored, high-quality support. Quote the Poolside Pass for an extra 10% discount. Okay, so I think it's about time I introduced Rob Greenwood. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Jeremy. Thanks for having me.
So why don't we just start by just hearing a little bit about you and your background within the sport?
It's always a bit of the boring bit, isn't it? But yeah. I'm not too dissimilar to most, really, and I'll brush over it as quick as I can. But started swimming at a young age. Probably one of the only differences is we were living abroad at the time. My father was based in Jakarta, Indonesia, so I learned from there at the British International School. Came back to the UK when I was 10, 11, club swimming, national age group some years, national age group not other years. Into sort of youth swimming, made European juniors a couple of times, early, mid to late 90s. And made the sort of, it was a bit of an easier progression for myself because it was Commonwealth Games 1998 off the back of European juniors, a bit of a softer meet to sort of blood yourself on a senior team perspective. But I made that team 1998, the 100 fly, the games right in Kuala Lumpur, and that was a fantastic experience. 99 World Short Course Championships, I think, if I remember rightly. And then we were into the Olympic Games in Sydney, and that was always a sort of big driver for me to try and qualify for the Olympic Games. I went to trials in that March, April time, and I think it was like 3/100ths or something outside the qualifying standard for the automatic selection. So it's absolutely, I think it was like, it might even be like 1/100 or something. And I was absolutely gutted. I'd come second to James Hickman, which is kind of what I thought I needed to do. I dropped a good 6 or 7 tenths off my best time. So I was pretty happy from that perspective, but absolutely gutted to miss the team. But as I was sort of driving home, I got a phone call actually from James Hickman, who said to me, listen, my coach, Terry Dennis at the time, has had a word with the PD and they decided to take you as an alternate for the relay. So from being absolutely lowest of the low to being on that team was, in the space of a couple of hours or whatever it was absolutely made up. So I went to the Olympic Games in Sydney, and I think that was a bit of a start of my sort of coaching philosophy, really, because at the time we had a PD. He was a great guy, a chap called Derek Snelling, a British chap that had been based out in Canada for a number of years, an amazing coach, coached some great Olympic champions in his time. But he had a philosophy really based around winning medals. And he was saying publicly that we were going to win medals in every single event that we were entered in. And if we had two people in that event, we'd be winning two medals. I'm really trying to big the team up with an element of positivity around the fact that we could and that we should be winning medals. And we went to that Games in Sydney and we had an amazing team, some fantastic swimmers, but we didn't win a single medal. I think our best position was fifth in the men's 4x2. I want to say we had some great swimmers on that team. We really did. People like Paul Palmer who medalled in 96, Graham Smith who did the same thing, Sue Roll. We had some amazing swimmers. But we came away from that Games without a single medal. And I remember thinking at the time, I don't actually recall a single athlete on that team swimming a best time.
Yeah.
So we'd gone to this Games, we'd been preparing for a number of years. And this is when, 96, 97, lottery funding came into the system. So we'd gone from this sort of really amateur approach to the sport, and we were transitioning into a more professional sort of outfit. bringing in sports scientists, physios, doctors, psychologists. We had training camps abroad. But we still had a bit of an amateur mindset about what we were doing as we were transitioning, like I say, into the professional world. But we went to that Games and we came away without a single medal. And that was a bit of a turning point for me, because I was always sort of time orientated. I think that's because I swam. For me, I thought the two best swimmers in the country at the time were Stephen Parry. From my perspective, was Stephen Parry and James Hickman, two fly swimmers that I was swimming against. So I never really had a chance to stand on top of the podium. So I think that's where my philosophy came. Well, I've just got to get better. I've just got to get faster. And for me, when the team was so focused on winning in terms of medals, we lost sight of what it actually took to swim faster than we were before. And I was listening to a podcast by Brett Hawke, who was interviewing Jeff Hugel, and he pretty much said the very similar thing. Jeff Hugel went into that 100 fly rank world number one, and he was so focused on beating Michael Klim, he forgot about Lars Frölander, who went in there and swam a lifetime best and took the medal from the pair of them as they were fighting it out. So that was a bit of a start of my philosophy, and we'll probably get into that. But that was the kind of pinnacle of my career, going to those Olympic Games. And off the back of that, we got a, no surprise, new performance director in Bill Sweetnam. And things really sort of changed from that point, really. I was lucky enough to swim under Bill. I swam for another couple of years. I went to the World Championships in 2001 and then just missed out on the Commonwealth Games in 2002 and decided at that point that I'd sort of call it a day. Started part-time coaching, bit of volunteering, and then I got a full-time position with a new program that started in sort of Lancashire-based area called Gallica. And it was great because it was with my former coach, Dave Everts, who's a top coach and top guy. So working alongside him, building a program from absolute scratch was a fantastic experience for me. And we had some great success early doors. And Dave moved on to work for British Swimming in 2005, 2006, and I took over as head coach of that program through to sort of 2008. The club in the first couple of years, we were top club at age groups for a couple of years on the bounce, top club at national youth championships, and that was really our focus, was sort of age and youth. We were sort of an age and youth program, and so the pinnacle of that was European Juniors and World Junior Championships. In 2008, we had, I think we won maybe four or five golds at World Junior Championships, and probably something similar to that at the European Junior Championships, and I think that was. It was no big surprise that that was sort of my opportunity then to make the move into a national training centre. I remember in Bill Sweetnam moved on the April before the Games in 2008, and they brought in a new PD, a new head coach, just before those Games, in Michael Scott and Dennis Pursley. And after the Games in 2008, I got to go there as part of a sort of educational package to sit up in the stands. It's actually with Mark Spack, which is a great opportunity to work with a couple of younger athletes and watch the Games from up in the stands, interact with some coaches, international coaches and athletes. And we came back from that Games and had a meeting with the PD, Michael, about an athlete that I was coaching that was looking to go to the States. And off the back of that meeting, they asked if I was interested in becoming one of the assistant coaches at an ITC. I don't even think I asked which ITC it was. I think I just said, yeah, okay. And they said, this is how much you get paid. And I said, can I have a bit more? And they said, no. And I said, okay, that's fine. I'll still go. I'll still start. When do you want me to kick off? And I think it was like, we had this conversation early October 2008. And by November 2008, I was up in Stirling, the assistant coach to the ITC there with Doug Frost, which was just an incredible experience. You know, Doug had come from Australia, having coached arguably one of the greatest swimmers of all time, Ian Thorpe, and the amount of knowledge that he brought. And that was a huge sort of transition for me from a coaching perspective, that move from club coaching into a national training centre. We can touch on that a little more if you want to. And Doug kind of moved on in 2000 and back end of 2010, he went back home to Australia. And then I became the head coach of the ITC into a home Olympic Games. And having been, you know, only club coach in 2 years prior to that. So that was a sort of baptism of fire, really.
Yeah.
A real challenge. And you know, we managed to put someone on that Olympic Games team in 2012, which we're really proud of. It was an athlete that had come through the Gallagher program as a youth swimmer, and we came close with one or two other athletes as well. So they were good times at up in Stirling, building that program alongside Ian Wright and Scottish swimming and British swimming, and the amount of influences we had from them, from Jonty Skinner to whoever it might have been. It was a good team and good times. And then in sort of late 2013, I moved on, and I took the decision I wanted to, you know, be my own man somewhat and be a head coach of a nation. And we got that opportunity within Paris swimming,
yeah,
into a Paralympic Games. And I think there's nothing better, the kind of pinnacle of a coaching career, to be head coach of the country going in a major games. And that's the opportunity that I was going to have in Rio in 2016. And we did. We did the job that I was sort of employed to do on that perspective, and after that games things happened, and we can talk about that. But I made the decision to move on and become again head coach of another opposing country back in the Olympic side of things, and that didn't work out. So in 2017, I moved over to Southeast Asia, working with a friend of mine through Thailand, and then hooked up with an old swimmer and good friend of the family, which was the Schoolings, Joseph Schooling, and opened up a swim school in Singapore with him in 2017-18, I think. And then my wife got pregnant, and I came back home about 18 months ago, the back end of her pregnancy, to start the family here, and the swim school continues over in Singapore. And it's been quite a journey this last sort of 5 or 6 years, but it's been an amazing experience nevertheless. So that's a kind of short synopsis of how I went from swimming into coaching, I guess.
So like, when was it during your career that you decided that you kind of set firm what kind of coaching model you'd use as a coach?
Oh, good question. I started coaching. I was kind of this thinking and understanding that I've never been a coach, and it's weird to say it, that was all, you know, massively turned on by athletes stood on top of the podium. If I had an athlete on the podium that maybe shouldn't have been there, or they're on top of the podium and it wasn't a great swim, it took the edge off for me, you know. And I almost got far more from an athlete that delivered an amazing performance that, you know, might have not even got out of heats, or, you know, came fourth or fifth or whatever. So I think that was the kind of point for me in terms of this process orientated coaching, where it was more about how you got the athlete to deliver a performance pretty early on. Like I say, that 2000 games was quite a big impact on me.
Yeah.
And made me realize that, you know, there's more to winning than being stood on the podium. For me, winning was defined by being able to go to the peak performance meet, whether it was national age groups, county championships, Olympic Games, and just swim faster than you'd ever been before. And I'd sort of solidified that philosophy very, very early on in my coaching career. But having said that, in 2004, 2005, 2006, 2007, and 2008, the program was having some amazing success at age group and youth level.
Yeah.
That you fill yourself up with a massive amount of confidence that you know what you're doing. And I didn't really know what I was doing at all. I was just delivering a version of what I had been doing from some of the amazing coaches that I had worked with. If someone had asked me, you know, three or four whys, or even a fifth why are you doing that for a fifth time, I've been struggling to answer that. And that's why that huge transition for me in 2008, going from age group coaching or youth coaching, a club setup to a national setup, was incredibly difficult. I went from, you know, a coach stood on the side of the pool with a stopwatch in my hand, coaching a group of aging youth swimmers who were just getting better just because they're getting bigger and stronger and what have you, to working in a national centre with a group of experts, whether it's the strength and conditioning coach, the physio, the doctor, the psychologist, a group of experts looking towards me as the coach for guidance, for help. What are they working towards? And I found that incredibly, incredibly difficult.
Yeah.
And it eroded away that thing that we have as coaches of confidence in what you're delivering. I started to ask myself, what is my philosophy? What am I about? How do I know if my athletes are getting better? What are the questions? What are the performance questions I need to be asking of the physio, of the doctor, of the S&C coach? They're looking to me for guidance, and I don't really have a solid foundation or philosophy to put back to them. So I was starting at that point to start to really think about what my coaching model was, and I didn't really have one. Like I say, it was a regurgitated version of some of the things that I did. But I had a lot of positive influences around me, a technical director in John T. Skinner, who was a coach slash physiologist for British Swimming. I'd had a lot of interactions through face-to-face or emails with Bob Trefine in terms of his philosophy, a great physiologist. Tim Kerrison in the early days when he was working at British Swimmer in terms of developing speed and anaerobic capacity or power. Mike Peregrine was a big influence from a physiology point of view. And then obviously we stumbled across an opportunity to work with Jan. And it was all of those influences that helped me get to the point where I am now, where I have a sort of philosophy around from a physiological point of view or a technical point of view or a people development point of view. I have a philosophy and a coaching model on how to deliver that. I think once you get to that point as a coach and you try and refine it and develop it, that's when a massive amount of confidence can really come from, an ability to can really come from. You have a model to work through.
Yeah.
You've got that structure to fall back on. But what I would say to any young coaches is embrace that process. You know, don't shy away. Don't take the easy road, which I took for a number of years of sitting back on the success that we have. And when you're coaching within a club, it's very, very hard. You're working in a silo. You're working on your own. It's very hard to have some interactions with people, and honest interactions, and challenging interactions to really ask yourself some tough questions about what it is that you do and why you do that. And I didn't have that opportunity while I was coaching within a club setup in Gallagher. I didn't have room for that. I was having such an amazing amount of success. But when I was surrounded by experts who were asking me those questions, I quickly realised that I didn't have a lot of the answers and needed to address that problem. So, and I think the further you're prepared to go in eroding away some of that confidence that you have as a young coach, the bigger the bounce will be when you come out the other end.
Yeah.
And I went pretty low with that through 2008, 2009, 2010, where I was questioning every single line in my book. You know, every single set I was doing. Do I want to be doing 4 200s or 5 200s? What am I doing? It was getting to that point where I was struggling to write a workout because I didn't have a purpose. I didn't have a process for what I was doing. And I was just living from day to day, and that is not a place you want to be for a long period of time. But like I said, prepared to go there, I think the bounce out the other end is worth it, because you're going to be somebody that's going to be prepared to pick up the phone, to go and see people, to be challenged, to be open, to be transparent, all those things you need to be to develop yourself. So it was a long process in terms of developing that coaching philosophy. And I think it is a long process. It takes time. It takes time. I would say 10 years to really sort of to get to that point where you're able to articulate it to others, to defend it, for it to be challenged, and for it to have gone through the experiences needed for you to be, okay, if this pops up, I know which direction to go in.
Yeah.
That kind of makes sense, Jamie.
Yeah, of course. So obviously, you kind of settled on the Jan Olbrich model of training. For those listeners that aren't aware of what it is, can you just give us like a very brief kind of background, kind of the philosophies behind it? I know it's difficult to do that because there's a book on it that's about, I don't know how many hundred pages long, but if you can.
Yeah. Well, the science of winning is a tough read at the best of times. But like all sort of white papers and scientific manuscripts, they're always tough reads. I kind of just skirt to the conclusions at the end and read them. But it's a good book if you can get your teeth into, if you can get your head around that, if you're that way inclined, give it a read. But like any philosophy, it takes a number of influence on that. Like I say, I was influenced by a number of physiologists, but I was also influenced by a number of coaches, whether it was Stefan Widmar, Doug Frost, John Rudd, Ben Titley, Dave Everts, Palace Wilderby, or, you know, I was coaching a lot of 200 freestylers at the time. So obviously Ian Turner was a big influence on me. He coached so many 200 freestylers. And this is, you know, the Olbrich model. You know, if Jan was sat here with me now, he'd be like, no, Rob, that's wrong. No, this is wrong. You know, this is my interpretation of it. And that is important as well, because none of us can deliver somebody else's coaching model. Yeah. If I write a workout for you, Jamie, you write one for me, we don't have the same passion about it. We don't have the same understanding of where it came from. And that goes to coaching models as well. And I think that's important, that it's a kind of mishmash of different influences that you have that are sort of funneled through this model. And Jan's model sort of made sense to me because, you know, I always understood that aerobic capacity was important. I always understood that anaerobic capacity was important. But how do you quantify that? And I was always a coach that was looking for objectivity within my coaching. I looked down the route of VO2 max testing with a group of athletes. I was always looking for something to say, that is the definitive number. I'd always done the 5-200 step test. I always did the 3-200 snapshot every Tuesday night with my athletes and recorded those numbers. So I was always that way inclined. And the opportunity to work with Jan just before the 2012 Olympic trials. And the first testing that we did was actually at the trials itself in the swim down pool with a group of athletes there. We wanted to peak physical condition. What was their VO2 max? What was their anaerobic capacity? And we tested the athletes there. And that was the sort of the start of that relationship. And I can't even remember how. I think I just emailed the guy out of the blue or something like that and asked him if he wanted to get involved in what we're doing. And he jumped to the chance as he does. And we built up that relationship from there. And for me, you know, I got four simple numbers. I got a number on the aerobic capacity. I got a number for the anaerobic capacity. And then I got numbers for the aerobic and anaerobic power. And from that, I could, with his help, write a training program for those athletes. And why it sort of spoke to me, and I kind of went into it, as you do, as you think you should do, rather skeptical of anything that you go into. One eye on, well, is this going to work? Is it not going to work? I don't know. I'll give it a try. I'll try and see what it's like. It really sort of hit home to me on the second round of testing that we did. I had a group of athletes, and we were trying to build aerobic capacity. And we were doing a series of work that I believed would build aerobic capacity. And when we got the numbers showed that that had done. And for me, that just gave me a huge amount of confidence that, yeah, okay, these numbers are reflective of the work that we've done. Therefore, if I can look back in history and be reflective, I can look forward from that as well and plan the next series of work. So for me, that's how that sort of relationship with Jan started, and the Jan sort of training philosophy around, you know, building capacities or building power is a pretty complex, but it's also a pretty simplistic one as well. And that is one of my values, that things are simple. And for me, it was, you know, we worked in 8 or 12 week cycles. And we tested every 8 or 12 weeks, and we wrote the training program going forward from there.
So you obviously use this model for quite a number of years now. You used it when you was at Stirling. used it when you was at Paris Swimming as well, and now use it in the club environment too. So do you find that it's easier to use in some environments rather than others? Is it suited some more than it has others, or is it uniform across the different environments you've been in?
Well, first of all, it's a kind of philosophy of the way of developing an athlete from a physiological point of view.
Yeah.
So there's a kind of, you know, my philosophy on how you build an athlete is intertwined with all those influences that I've talked about, especially
Yeah.
And when I was working for British Swimming and we're in the ITC and still, and we have that opportunity to work with Jan, there's a financial cost to that, and we have the resources to test our athletes, all of them, on a regular basis, and then have the conversations with Jan off the back of it to write the training program. When I moved to British Para Swimming, we started off using and interacting with Jan, but I felt like I wanted something maybe a little bit different. I wanted a little bit more autonomy over what I was doing. So I kind of moved away a little bit from actually working with Jan. I was still on a sort of, I was still working with Scottish Swimming and the ITC up there, up until the Commonwealth Games in 2014, and they were interpreting the testing from Jan. And like I said, I'd done a little bit of testing with the para guys, but I wanted to be able to, like I say, a bit more autonomy over what I was doing. And I used the Jan model, but did my own tests, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So the philosophy of how you develop those elements of physiology through what Jan had done, the experience that he'd had, continue to use for the testing that I do. And it's simple, you know, if I want to test aerobic capacity, a 5200 step test is a great way of doing that. You know, whether you do each 200 with a full recovery or you do a 200 on 6 minutes five times, you're looking for a shift to the right on that graph. It's a great way of measuring in a simplistic way whether an athlete is gaining in an aerobic sense. And then for me, and it was a test that we used to do in Stirling at the ITC and within British Para Swimming as well, from an anaerobic point of view. And Jan was as equally interested in the testing that we were doing that was outside of the testing that he was doing, if that makes sense. If I did a time 2000, he wanted the result. If I did a 5200 step test, he wanted that result. If we did a blood test, he wanted that result. I'll never forget, it was an interesting story. And this is another story that kind of made me think this guy like knows his stuff. I did a blood test with an athlete. We used to do full blood tests twice a year, and we did a blood test with one of the athletes. And something that was just not quite right with this athlete. His capacities hadn't moved in the same direction that they'd moved previously with the training program been in. And I was speaking to Jan on the phone, and he said, Rob, he's never had any issues with his teeth, have you? He has. Just that his iron levels don't seem quite right. I was like, he had to have 3 teeth taken out like a month ago. He's like, yeah, there's a problem with his blood and his teeth. There could be an infection. It was just like, this guy knows everything. And and that was like another sort of confidence booster for me, that this guy really knows what he's talking about. He could interpret the blood data. He could interpret the testing. But like I said, he wanted to know what we were doing for other tests that we were doing to reinforce what he was telling us. So we used to do a simple, like a Wingate test, like a cycle test. A variant of that. So it was 40 seconds on, 20 seconds rest, 20 seconds on. So we kind of modified that into a 75 all out effort, and that was our anaerobic capacity test. And we'd have sort of float through to the 100, so 20 seconds rest, then an all out 50. And that was our power element, that was our anaerobic power element. Yeah. And however, how close the 250s were together through the 75 and the push 50, that percentage gave us an element of how a state of readiness. If you imagine at the beginning of the season, you do a 75 max long course, you take the time at 50, take the time at 75, they float through to the 100, a few seconds rest, and then a push 50. How close the two 50s are together, there's going to be a wide gap at the beginning of the season. But as you move into the competition, closer to that peak performance meet, those 50s are going to come a little bit closer together. And that's the power element, the anaerobic power of that athlete, shifting towards a state of readiness. So when you wanted those results as well, like I say, it was a simple Wingate test. Well, I used our anaerobic capacity, anaerobic power test within British Para Swimming. I used the 5200s to interpret our training paces for that next block of work. And became sort of autonomous in my, you know, I wasn't reliant upon Jan's availability or whether he could do the test or not. I could, you know, self-sustainable in that sense. Yeah. And I've just taken a watered down, lightened version of that into sort of age and youth swimming, because I think Jan's sort of basic philosophy of, you know, if you want to build aerobic capacity, swimming around lactate 1.5 to 2, it's a very, very low intensity that can be transferred very easily into age group swimming, you know. But I try and individualize their training paces, even at club level, through the 5200s, and just get a simple training pace from that.
Yeah.
So yeah, definitely using his philosophy, but sort of put my own kind of spin on it with my own testing.
So you spoke about how you designed your blocks of training in kind of blocks of 8 to 12 weeks. Just talk me through kind of how you go about planning your cycles and your season then within that.
Well, I used to sit down at the beginning of the season, do like, right, 11 months. Here's the main meet, work backwards from there, write my training program. And quickly realized it was a little bit of a waste of time. Okay, we know when the competitions are, whether it's trials, the benchmark meets, testing, whatever it might be. But in terms of actual detail of what the workouts or the focus of that block of work might be, do we really know what we're going to be, what state of readiness that athlete's going to be in 12, 13, 14, 20 weeks time? It's a tough one. So with Jan, we'd obviously know when the trials were, we'd know when the benchmark meets were, we knew what we were working towards, we'd plan the competition calendar, but the training program would probably only ever be 8 to 12 weeks in advance, maximum. And it'd only be, we'd work in, depending on which athlete was which, there might be 3 weeks on, 1 week recovery, or 2 weeks on, 1 week recovery, or some athletes 1 week on, 1 week recovery, depending on, like I say, who they were. And we were just working those cycles, and each athlete would have their own training places, their own programs. And I wanted best I can to group the athletes together as much as possible. So I did have, you know, we had a group of athletes working together, but I'd work in 8 to 10 week cycles maximum, but only work in sort of 1 to 2 weeks of actual detail. And one of the things about the YAM program that was slightly different, not slightly, was very different from what I was doing before, and it's a good point to make, is that you'd always say the body is a really, really simple thing. It only likes simple messaging or simple impulses. Mm-hmm. If you want to build aerobic capacity, then focus on building aerobic capacity and don't do everything in the week. Don't put a little bit of everything in the week and confuse the system and dumb down the adaptation. If I want to get better at squats and go in the gym and squat, my legs are going to be sore the next day, I'm going to get domed. There's the adaptation from that. No point going and doing, you know, bench pressing and those things. It ain't going to work. If I want to build aerobic capacity, then I need to focus on aerobic capacity. The physiology of the body, it doesn't really go hand in hand in building, let's say, aerobic power or anaerobic power whilst trying to build a capacity in an athlete. They're just conflicting messages to the body and conflicting systems that's going to have a detrimental impact longer term, from my point of view, on what that athlete's doing, and that could make the program a little bit boring, for want of a better word. Sometimes you would have to try and think of ways of stimulating the athlete's mental point of view. If you can imagine that you've got an athlete that's 6 to 7 weeks of aerobic capacity training, can get a little bit monotonous. So you know, there was a lot of technical inputs in there. We tried to have, you know, 1 to 3 technical points that athlete would be asked to work on through each of the workouts. But It could get a little bit monotonous from a mental point of view, because there's extremes of intensity in that program.
Yeah.
That's what it's about. And for me, that gives trainability to the athlete. If the athlete is limited with the number of gears they have, 1, 2, or 3, for example, you're limited in what you can do with that athlete. But if they have a larger spectrum of capacity, i.e. they've got first gear nice and steady, but they've got a 5th, 6th, or 7th gear, then you've got this huge training opportunity of pushing the intensities at both both ends. And for me, training is about intensity. It's about intensity. Yeah. It's about 100% output, all nice and steady. How do you push the envelope from a capacity point of view? And if you can get that balance right, then you've got a really great opportunity when you shift into that sort of power phase, that sort of race conditioning, to really get the athlete in the shape that they need to be to deliver the event that they're swimming for.
So when you, like you say, obviously it's got its battles in terms of the monotony, and it can be quite boring if you're doing, you know, long blocks of work on aerobic capacity. How does that sort of, now in within the program you work, you've got like age group swimmers in there as well. How does that work with them? Because if it's boring for them, you know, they'll really struggle to do it. So how do you kind of get around that?
Yeah, and I think it's easy as coaches, isn't it, to you know, you've got your key workout in the week to get motivated and up for that key workout and deliver a great coaching session. But for me, the sessions that you've got to coach and the ones that you've got to work on are those low level long swims, you know, aerobic capacity workouts. Those are the sessions that you've really got to be coaching.
Yeah,
the tough top end workouts, the intensity workouts, key workouts in the week, they take care of themselves. The athletes get themselves up for that. They can deliver that, not a problem. But it's those, you know, it's the five or six other workouts in the week where it's steady state, like I say, lactate 1.5, lactate 2, or 50 to 60 beats below, fat metabolism work, way below threshold kind of effort. Those are the workouts that you've got to coach. Those are the workouts that you've got to interact with the athletes with. It's just keeping on top of the times, making sure they're not going too quick or too slow, whether it's keeping on top of them from a technical point of view, trying to keep them present in the workout. And that's the tough thing, isn't it? That athletes, they come to the workouts and they've got a million different things going on and get distracted. You know, a sort of mantra of mine is sort of around focus, consistency, confidence, performance. And athletes have got to be focused on the workout in hand. They've got to be focused on their rest and recovery, focused on their nutrition, focused on their race processes to get a level of consistency in what they're doing. And what we're striving for, whether you're working in a national training centre or you're working within a club environment, is consistency.
Yeah.
Consistency of work, consistency at skill level, technique, consistency of performance. All those things lead towards where you want to be. And what I would do is sit down with my coaching group the night before, you know, Olympic trials or Paralympic trials or Paralympic games, to say, right, okay, what's Jamie going to do on this 200 freestyle tomorrow? What time is he going to go? Is it going to be a PB? If so, why? If it's not, why? And reflecting back on the meet and the result of the meet prior to the performance, yeah, if that makes sense. It's a really interesting thing to do. And you could do it within a club environment for the group as a whole. You know, how are these group of athletes going to perform? And sort of that second guessing what you're doing really reinforces or makes you think about the process that you've just been through. But getting back to your question, I think you've got to coach those workouts and you've got to be involved in what they're doing. And sometimes we want to just sit back and it's a low level recovery workout and let them kind of get on with it. But I do that, but also I think those are the workouts that athletes can just lose a little bit of focus. They become distracted. They're not present in the workout. And, you know, technique can shift in a negative direction to coach those workouts for sure.
You spoke earlier as well about, you know, you believe training is all about intensity and being able to push the envelope on that. Where do you stand then on kind of USRPT, because that's primarily all about the intensity. So where are you on that?
I've not done a massive amount of reading on it, so I'm by no means well versed on USRPT. But it's a bit of a weird one. I was talking to a coach this morning actually about USRPT, and there seems to be not a fascination with it, but it seems to be a bit of a hot topic at the moment.
Yeah.
There's so many training models out there that would be great to to discuss and dissect and talk about. But USRPT looking at it from an intensity point of view, I don't know, 2025s or 2050s at race pace. For me, race pace for some athletes isn't that fast. And one thing I found, if you're a 200 freestyler training at race pace and training, you need to be off a really, really short turnaround to make that up. But for me, that's a different level of intensity to an all-out 100% effort. And that's what the Albrecht model for me is, of a higher intensity than USRPT.
Yeah.
From my perspective, because it's singular, all-out, 100% effort, pushing the physiology, pushing the envelope of capacity of what that athlete can do. So therefore, the week and the entire program needs to be really built around being able to deliver a specific workout. Yeah. And an example of that, I was working, I had the opportunity to work with Ross Murdoch. What an incredible athlete he was, an amazing adapter to strength. Would only need, and it's a great way of thinking about your training. An athlete only needs a certain amount of inputs, or should only need a limited amount of inputs to gain an adaptation. If it takes a coach 48 weeks to get an adaptation out of an athlete, what has that coach been doing? It's a number of workouts. So an example of that is Ross was very versed in aerobic capacity and his anaerobic capacity. To build power in him, he would only need 2 or 3 traditional VO2 heart rate or aerobic power workouts in that cycle. So in a season, he might do 6.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
And a set for him might be, let's say, 3 100s breaststroke, 100% effort on 1:20. So instead of the traditional Bob Trofee model of, let's say, 24 or 32 100s off 1:45, much more rest, we would go 3 100s off 1:20. So considerably tougher turnaround, 1:15, 1:20, 1:15, something around there, and then a full recovery. So yeah. For me, that intensity is incredibly high compared to a more traditional model of, so let's say, 3100s off 1:45. You know, the guy's going 63, 6400 breaststroke for 3 or 4 100s, full recovery, then let's go again. Full recovery, we're talking 10, 15, 20 minutes recovery, then go again. Let's see how many rounds that we can do of that. So for me, the YAM model really lends itself, because everything else is so steady, lactate 1, lactate 1.5, or lactate 2, it's really steady swimming, that you're able to swim at a much, much higher intensity. And the workouts as well are just, like I say, slightly different from the traditional model. So getting back to your question on USRPT, I don't think I know enough about it. I'd like to see perhaps the successes of more athletes potentially doing it. But right now, I think it's very limited with who's doing it and what they're doing and whether they're sort of truly following it. But I think there's other models out there that are worth more time and energy into researching than perhaps USRPT. But I'm sure it's got its place within a season or within a workout. But for me, like I say, it's not something I'm well versed in.
So I just want to spend a little bit of time talking about, obviously, briefly in the intro there, you mentioned you've kind of had, in the last kind of few years of your career, you've had some difficult times in terms of your career and your coaching. How have you managed to kind of move through that and kind of bounce back, essentially?
It's a tough question, really, Jamie, because
yeah,
there's so many unanswered questions. You know, I've moved to from Stirling to British Paris, moving back into my sort of hometown in Manchester, which was fantastic. I worked with some amazing people within British Paris, and it was such a wonderful experience for me. And I was, I came out of that experience a much better coach.
Yeah.
Through moving into the para program. And we went to the Rio Games, and I think, I was under no illusions, despite it not being part of my philosophy, that we had to deliver medals. And in London, there were 7 gold medals won by the team, and in Rio, we won 16. And we kind of changed the trajectory of the gold medal return over a number of years. a more positive return. And we'd had a fantastic game, and the sort of pinnacle of my career really was the Rio Paralympics, and coming back from there and being sports coach, high performance sports coach of the year, and things like that. It was amazing. But I knew I wanted to be back within the Olympic program, and when I got that opportunity, albeit with another country, to become head coach of their nation, again head coach but coaching as well, that's something I wanted to do. It's something I did at British Para Swimming, and for that to be sort of for that opportunity not to come through because of complications, shall we say, or a complaint that had come through from my time at British Para Swimming, was a hard pill to swallow, because I'm not sure I'd do things particularly differently, if at all. When my time through British Para Swimming, it was a great experience, and I still feel that way about it, and it's made me a better coach. But it was just a very, very sort of strange ending to my whole 9-10 years within British Swimming.
Yeah.
And it obviously affects things going forward. You know, I Google my name and it's like, you know, Rob Greenwood, bully coach, and all these things. And every coach out there has a disagreement with a parent or an athlete, and we've probably all been there, or we'll probably all be there at some point. But for me, for it to be on the 6 o'clock news while I'm eating my tea was just a very bizarre,
strange
sort of events to go through, and I could not see. I don't really think there's been a positive outcome for anybody involved in the whole thing. It was just absolutely farcical in many ways, and completely blown out of all proportion, really, with a narrative that sport only wins medals because it's buying it or bullying people over the line, but it's just not the case. And I deal with it well, and I carry on and crack on with what I'm doing. I'm a proactive person. I look forward, I'm not someone that looks back, as difficult as that time might have been, because ultimately I'm proud of the job I did, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I'm happy with what was achieved, how we went about achieving it. I'm cool with that. I'm fine with that.
Yeah.
It's caused me difficulties going forward, absolutely. But I'm transparent. I'm happy to talk about it. I'm happy to talk with parents or athletes. And there's obviously concerns when you move into a club program. But is this guy going to be bullying my kids and stuff? And I have great relationships with the parents that I work with, and I have great relationships, I believe, with the athletes that I work with.
Yeah.
I'm not going to let that point in time define me going forward. It won't get to me in that sense.
So you speak about, you know, being head coach of Para Swimming, developing your career, making you a better coach. Let's talk a little bit more about what you feel you gained from your time at Para Swimming, because you feel like you really moved on your career whilst you were there.
Yeah, I got the opportunity to really put into place a plan to deliver success at a major game, along with the PD, Chris Berber. You know, we were all about delivering lifetime bests. We were all about PB in the finals.
Yeah.
At the Rio Games, we were genuinely, I couldn't even tell you what UK sport medal, you know, what they were asking us to do. I wasn't, believe it or not, interested in athletes stood or not stood on the podium. You know, we had a bell at the Rio Games that we rang for every athlete that swam a PB. That was, we celebrated that as much as we celebrated people stood on the podium. We celebrated the PB as much. And we put a plan in place to, the plan is about clarity of purpose, you know, and our purpose was to go to the games and swim quicker than we'd ever been before. We worked back to that point. And if you've got clarity of purpose, i.e. what you're about, then you can start putting your process in place. Because if you haven't got a process, you don't have a plan. And if you don't have a plan, you don't really know what you're doing. And it's detail, you know, We had to think about the meals that we were going to eat on the plane. We had to think about the days that we would travel from London to Rio. We had to think about the day that we would go to the competition pool. I remember walking into the competition pool in Sydney in 2000, 4 or 5 days before, and the Australian team were training, and there were 6,000 people in the stand watching the training workout. And I couldn't sleep for 2 days. Yeah. I was just so hyped and buzzed about it. It was just like, so in Rio, we took the opportunity to not go to the competition pool till maybe the night before and just have a look around, keep it low key. We went into the village very late, maybe 4 or 5 days. I think it was before the meet started. So our purpose around delivering lifetime best performances had a really robust plan. I was integral in doing that. Language that we used on a day-to-day basis within the National Training Centre. When I started in the National Training Centre, we had 2 athletes, and I think by the end of the first month, we maybe only had 1. But prior to Rio, the National Centre was full. There was a real buzz about what we were doing, and a real movement and momentum towards having the ability, I felt, to swim best times in the finals when we got there. I think in London, the PB rate was maybe about 32-33%. When you think about it, if you've been working towards something for 4 years and the PB rate being in and around that, it's very, very hard to deliver medal success when you're down there. And I think in some of the nights in Rio, we were up at 50, 60, 70%. And I think we finished around 44, 45%. So we're nice. And, you know, the first couple of days in Rio, from an outsider looking in, didn't necessarily go to plan. I don't think we won. Had a check, but I don't think we converted, or I don't think we won some of the medals we thought we were going to win. But the Paralympic Games is a 9 or 10 day event. It's a marathon. You have to be prepared for that, and that was part of our planning as well, being prepared for such a long meet.
Yeah.
And I knew that if our athletes could continue to swim PBs, which they'd done on the first day, the meet would come to us. We didn't have to chase it anymore. We didn't have to get excited. We didn't have to start analysing what was going on or not going on. Just continue what we're doing and the medals will come. We don't need to worry about that. We've picked a team of athletes that are talented enough, have worked hard enough to be competitive on an international stage. And if they're swimming best times and getting beat, fair due to the Chinese or fair due to the Brazilians for doing that. Fair play. If their athletes are beating our athletes and we're swimming PBs, then wow,
they're
doing something really well. And the meat started to come back to us, you know? And then again, that's just having the confidence in your philosophy and it not wavering even under the pressure of a Paralympic Games whilst you're in the midst of it. And I was having conversations with the other coaches. The team leader, how do you think we're doing? We're doing fine. We're doing great. Our athletes are well prepared on delivering best times. The meet will come to us. Let's not worry about it. Let's stick to our process. Let's stick to our plan. And that was an amazing experience to be part of that, working with an amazing group of athletes, an amazing group of support staff and coaches. And there was real synergy, I think, between the sort of the team, whether it was swimmers or coaches, there was synergy. People, whether it wasn't their job, saw the gaps and picked it up. People supported each other. It was good. It was an experience that, contrary to popular belief, was an experience I very much enjoyed, and was an experience that I think a lot of people had found extremely positive, and definitely shaped me.
So just before we finish, I'm just going to ask you for your 3 top points for developing and choosing a model for younger coaches, really.
That's a tough one, because I think it's quite an organic process.
Yeah.
I think I don't think you could be like, okay, I'm going to hone my training philosophy and I'm going to do it over the next 24 hours. It takes time. And things will happen, performances will happen, training adaptations or training plans that will start to inform. And I think that's the sort of key to it, really. write a training program or a philosophy that is going to inform you going forward. If I ever spoke to coaches and say, okay, you know, what are you doing in this next block of work? I'm working on, you know, a heart rate workout where I want to get this, or VO2 workout where I want to race pace. How do you know if that's been successful? What does success look like for this period of time in this block of training or competition? And if you can answer that question, then there's an element of objectivity to what you're doing. And once you get that, it can really help shape your philosophy and your training programs. And like I say, I was influenced by a great many physiologists, Jan included in that, and a great many coaches that have helped shape my philosophy. And it's a mishmash of all those things. So what I would say is, you know, read, talk to people, be historic in the sense of, you know, some of the best coaches I've worked with. I remember John Rudd. I know you've spoken to John Rudd, but if you ever get hold of John Rudd's logbook, it is like a piece of art. You open it up and it is absolutely pristine. And everything is on there that athlete has done in that workout. And it is, the detail in there is just, and it's beautifully written. I mean, his spoken word is fantastic, but his written word is equally as good. And it's really is a work of art. And I think, you know, having reference points to, as you're developing these training models, are really, really important, because you can go back and look at what you've done. You know, I've recorded how many hours we've swam, how many times, you know, land work we've done, how much has been kick, how much has been a rope, all of those things in the past to just help try and, you know, inform what I'm doing. And yeah. Jan helps because he gives you some numbers. But Bob Trafine helps with his training model around heart rate, or Tim Harrison's model around developing speed. They're all informed training models, and I think that's a great word. But don't be afraid to lose confidence with it. Don't be afraid to you know, not have the answers and to go deep with them. I think for me that's an important message, that you know you're not gonna have all the answers all the time. And I think the further you'll go, the deeper you're prepared to go with asking yourself why or what the hell am I doing, and like I said, I think the bigger the bounce will be, because you're that kind of person that's not afraid to say, you know, I don't know what I'm doing in that sense.
Cool. So Rob, thank you very much for your time. It's been great to speak to you. I certainly learned a lot from our conversation. I hope the coaches that listened will as well. Listeners, thank you very much for tuning in. If you've not done so already, check out our website, www.thepoolsidepass.com. And we're on social media, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at The Poolside Pass. I hope you found today's episode useful. I certainly did. Until next time, make sure you keep learning. And yeah, in any way you can, just keep coaching.